When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Hey, Ben, you know what I love?
No.
Jesus. Wow. You know what else I love?
Incredible.
I love talking about mammon. Because it's super dope and people don't really know what that word means. And Jesus talks a lot about money, which is the, we'll talk about this in the interview. Mm-hmm. And we got to talk to Malcolm Foley about mammon today. Yeah. And I also love quick introductions, which is this one.
This is what's that. Although I do have to interrupt you just a little bit, just to clarify something. You said you love Jesus. And then you said you also thought that mammon was pretty dope. But
yeah.
Jesus himself said that you cannot serve both God and mammon. So I don't know what to think about that. If you think mammon's dope and you say you love Jesus.
Yeah, did you just...
I don't know.
Did you just Jesus juke me? You just Jesus juked me.
Or maybe mammon juked you? I'm not sure which one. But I did. I definitely juked you.
Discussing mammon is dope.
That's what you meant.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
I thought you just loved money.
Well,
yeah.
No. But there's a lot of anxiety right now around economics and jobs and people losing jobs. And we just tried to get Christy connected on to do this intro with us for about 20 minutes. And her microphone seems to be going out. Yeah, so we may need
technology is having troubles there.
Yep. May need to spend some money there on a new microphone for her. So anyway, this is timely.
This is timely because we have to, you know, it's confusing sometimes for people to think about this because we cannot, you know, you can't just like seal yourself off in your own little bubble and say, I'm not going to use money. I'm going to create my own little society that, you know, is completely sealed off from the influence of mammon. You can't do that. You got to live in this world. And how do you live faithfully as a trickster?
Yeah. Anyway. You know, one person who can help us with that is Malcolm Foley, who is a pastor, historian, and speaker who serves as special advisor to the president for equity and campus engagement at Butler University. He has written for Christianity Today, The Anxious Bench, and Mere Orthodoxy. Foley co-pastors Mosaic Waco, a multicultural church in Waco, Texas, where he lives with his wife, Desiree, and he's written a book we're talking about with him today, The Anti-Greed Gospel, Why the Love of Money is the Root of Racism, and How the Church Can Create a New Way Forward. Let's get into it. Reverend Dr. Malcolm Foley, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you guys.
I am looking forward to this conversation a lot. But before we jump into greed and the gospel and what to do with the mess we find ourselves in, I wonder if you could share a bit of your spiritual story with us, you know, how you were raised, and then maybe some seminal moments that led you to be the Christian that you are today.
Yeah. So grew up in the faith. My mom and dad are faithful believers, and I can't remember there being a time when I didn't believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, that he died and was raised and was raised for me. When I was in 10th grade, I took a class, a comparative religion class. My teacher was an atheist, and specifically had an issue with with Christianity. And so, and so he and I would have conversations back and forth. We'd trade books back and forth. That got me into church history and theology. But I was a math, science, and computer science guy. So I did, so in undergrad, I did a religious studies and finance double major with a classics minor, where it was all just ancient Greek. Yeah, all this is going to come together. All this comes together. So religious studies and finance, classics minor, which was all ancient Greek. And then, and it was in between my junior and senior year of college. I interviewed for investment banking firms, and it was over the course of that process, I was like, actually, I don't think I want to do this. And so I applied to seminaries instead and did that, and fell in love with particularly, the Greek church fathers, especially Cyril of Alexandria and Maximus the Confessor. And I thought I was going to do my dissertation on that. I was especially running from conversations about race because just as a black scholar, I knew people were going to ask me race questions, and I was like, I don't want to talk about that. There's other stuff I want to do. Then over the course of my PhD, it was like halfway through the PhD, I came into contact with this question about lynching that I addressed in the book, and it arrested me. To the extent that I couldn't get away from it, and so I was like, I guess this is what the Lord has for me to do, and it's revealed to me basically a cosmic battle that I think the church is currently in the midst of, which is as Jesus says in Matthew 6:24, he can't serve two masters, and the master that he chooses, as opposed to God, is mammon or money and riches. And I'm deeply convinced that the history of race in this country, the history of race and racism, is really just a proxy battle of that war. So that has shaped, it's kind of reshaped my own ministry. It's reshaped my preaching. It shapes a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Gosh, there's like six things in there I want to talk about, including I don't think Maximus the Confessor is punk AF. That he will mess you up, man. And that guy is legit a brilliant, brilliant dude. I would love to chat about that for 30 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
but also, let's talk about mammon, because honestly, I get people all the time telling me, you have to choose a different word. You can't you can't use that word. I'm like, well, Jesus chose that word.
Yep.
And they're like, well, and then I have other people who think it's manna. People are like, what do you have against manna?
Yeah.
So let's talk about that word mammon.
Yeah.
Why do you choose to use that word? What does it mean? And what benefit or work does that word do that maybe just saying money or greed doesn't. Yep.
So I use it because Jesus uses it, but it's an Aramaic word that means money or riches, and it's really interesting that Jesus doesn't that the way that the text comes to us is not through just kind of a Greek word for money, but that it's an Aramaic word. I mean, I take it to point to really a demonic reality that the masters that we're choosing between are actual personal masters. And so the option is either God or the demonic reality of mammon. And so in giving it that name, I think it reminds us that the evils that we face are deeply personal. And it also reminds us, and I'd say this, I think about this, especially in the context of our conversations about race, it can be very easy for our conversations to be just either just about the personal or a kind of impersonal understanding of the systemic. And I want to bring us back to the personal, but not each other, because our enemies are not flesh and blood. Our enemies are the powers and principalities, and the spiritual forces of darkness in the heavenly places. And so I want the stakes of this conversation to be very clear. So when Paul in 1 Timothy 6 will say that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, but will also say that the one who desires to get rich also falls into a trap and a snare. Mm-hmm. And then we're immediately told, man of God or woman of God, flee from these things. Like the reason why those admonitions are so intense is because you are up against a very personal kind of evil, a very insidious kind of evil, and one that is after our deepest allegiance. I'm convinced now, even though I come out of in many ways Reformed contexts where pride is the queen of the vices, I'm deeply convinced actually the primary issue is greed. Yeah. Even when we look at kind of what Adam and Eve do, it's not just the kind of desire to be God, but it's the desire to kind of reach out and grab something that was not yours to reach out and grab.
Yeah.
You would have found out if you had waited a little longer that the Lord seeks to share everything that he has with you. That you do not have to live a life of just grasping for more, when the Lord has a future for you where he literally shares everything that he has with you, because that was his intention from the beginning. But greed is that thing, and worship of mammon is that thing that blinds us to those realities.
Yeah, I think I really appreciate the way that you're talking about this, and I think one of the main arguments of your book is that greed is actually what's behind racism, right? That the love of money is actually what produces the concept of race, and then the racism that we see. So they're not the invention of hatred; they're created by greed. And I know this is a historical, theological point that you're trying to make. We've talked a little bit about this in the past on the podcast, but I think it's such a big paradigm shift for a lot of people, because the message that we've heard, this is part of the power of those systems, right? It's just like we assume it's about like hatred, it's about animus, it's about like personal feelings of like ill will towards another person, but actually, underneath it all, it's about greed. So I wonder if you can just talk about how this reality became clear to you, and then what are maybe one or two pieces of evidence for this thesis that you think are the most compelling?
Yeah, I was, I thought this was an epiphany for me in like 2022, but then I listened back to a podcast that I did a few years ago, and it was there too. So it's been percolating for a while. But one of the points that I think is most salient to me, and I have this phrase in the book where I'm like, hey, when the Portuguese encountered chattel slavery, they didn't get involved because they were racist. They got involved because they had markets they wanted to expand. And I mean, what motivates you to do those kinds of things? Like hate, I mean, hate can motivate you to do a lot of stuff. But like money can motivate you.
Yeah.
Like money really motivates you. Mm-hmm. And even as a historian, because I started the PhD planning to be a historically informed theologian, and then because I did my PhD in the history of Christianity, they re-socialized me as a historian. But as you see in this book, it's like half history, but then it's very much half theology and ethics. But one of the things that I learned through those studies is even just looking through human history, one of the most significant motivators for people is personal gain, whether monetary or power, and people are also really susceptible to using whatever narratives are at hand for them in order to justify those kinds of things. So whether they're religious narratives or other narratives, when you ask the question of, well, where does the money lead? You find that, oh wait, this person actually may have made this decision because it led to significant profit for them. So when we think about the Portuguese and chattel slavery, the narratives about Christianizing the heathen or civilizing the savage or the specific ways in which blackness and whiteness show up as concepts during that period, the reason is because we've got to find reasons to continue to make all this money.
Yeah,
because it's great. It is great money. Free labor, great money. So, yeah. And so that logic applies there. And as I argue in the book, the logic actually also applies to the period of lynching. So that's my, historical specialty. And a lot of people think about that period as just a period of, well, like crazed mobs of white people just killing black men. And one of the things that I want to press is that it actually begins and continues because of the desire for money and power, and it ends because of that too. It doesn't end because people realize, wait a minute, this is an evil thing that we're doing to each other. Mm-hmm. No, it ends because it becomes a national embarrassment. It starts to stanch the flow of investor capital to the South. It starts to become an embarrassment when you've got editorials coming out of like France and Japan saying, "Oh my gosh, these Americans, it's crazy over there." Mm-hmm. That's not good for our reputation. It's not good for business. Mm-hmm. And that's how you stop something by making it bad for business.
Yeah. Oh man, there's so much in there.
We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling. And it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. That key of like the Portuguese sort of inventing race to justify sort of the extraction and claiming of bodies. I think the most powerful writing I've read on that, before I read your book, was Michael Harriet's book, Black AF History.
Yeah.
And he's got his second chapter is the church fight that started slavery. And he describes how the Portuguese in this colonial land resource grab were late to the game, and how like creating the theological and economic justification for treating black bodies the way other people treated allspice and cinnamon, was part and parcel to the racial construct we have today. And I just felt like it was such a powerful, helpful rubric then to come back to talking about our world today. I know I don't want to skip over lynching. We can get back to that.
Yeah.
But you describe our current political economy, which, by the way, I've had people ask me, why do you say political economy? I'd love to hear more from you about why not just politics, why not just economy, why both? Mm-hmm. But you describe it as racial capitalism or racialized capitalism. Mm-hmm. So help us understand why you describe our political economy as racialized capitalism, and what is the significance of a political economy? Why would we even want to talk about that?
Yeah. So I use the term, and I, you know, I interchangeably use racial capitalism and racialized capitalism, but I take it from the Black radical tradition, where historically the history of capitalism and the history of race are the same history, where the reason why race exists is specifically to justify structures of economic exploitation. And so when we think about our political economy, so which is broadly kind of the distribution of power and of resources in our society, it needs us to place one another in categories where there are some people who are fully people and others who are exploitable things. And who fits into those categories may change, but the need to put people in those categories remains. Cedric Robinson in his book, Black Marxism, argues that even before the particular kind of racial capitalism that we know now in Europe, kind of within European communities, you have the categorization of people as like, these are the people who are meant to be slaves. So this is where the word Slavic, like Slav, the word means slave, because like, these are the people who are supposed to be slaves. But that kind of logic is what then extends into our current economy, that there are people who belong in a particular category that allows us to treat them like exploitable things.
Yes.
I narrate that logic in the book as what I call a demonic cycle of self-interest that begins in the desire to exploit and dominate each other, because we like money and we like power. But the thing is, if we're going to exploit and dominate each other, people don't like to be exploited and dominated. So we have to employ violence in order to keep them in those kinds of positions. But because a lot of us have consciences, not all of us, but a lot of us do, we don't like to wake up and think, ah, what a wonderful day of exploiting, dominating, and killing my neighbor. So we create categories in order to tell ourselves that that's not what we're doing to each other, that actually these people are supposed to be in these kinds of situations, that actually these people are probably suffering because of something about them. And so we construct these lies, and it creates this cycle of exploitation, violence, and lies, exploitation, violence, and lies, exploitation, violence, and lies. And this is broadly what I'm talking about when I talk about a political economy of racialized capitalism.
Yeah.
And this is something I also that I draw from Jonathan Tran and others. It also requires me to think about the faith that we claim as a political economy as well. Mm. That the kingdom of God is also a political economy. It's a just one. Mm-hmm. And so if the one that we live in is one that's rooted in exploitation, violence, and lies, then the one that flows out of the gospel actually actively resists each of those three points as well. So as I argue in the book, the three ways in which Christian communities are called to do that is contra exploitation, where communities of deep economic solidarity, contra the violence that enforces that exploitation, we're to be communities of creative anti-violence, and contra the lies that justify that cycle, we're supposed to be communities rooted in prophetic truth telling.
Yes.
And all those things, like none of those things are like things that super Christians do. Like this is all just basic. This is basic Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so the goal even of the book, because it's a book that kind of purports to be about race, but it's really about more than it's really about much more than that. Because the fact of the matter is that race is a justifying and mystifying smokescreen. I want us to look behind. I want us to look behind the veil to see essentially the wizard who's pulling all the strings, and its name is Mammon. And so And so I want us to not only see the demon as it is, but also to strike it at its eyes and its heart rather than its extremities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, looping back around, connecting the dots here to Maximus the Confessor and others, you make a lot of use in this book of the church fathers. And I wonder if you could just, I don't know, for maybe a lot of our listeners, people think of them as like, they wrote some weird stuff a long time ago. That's when they were figuring out what the Trinity was, you know, et cetera. But what do they, I wonder if you can tell us, like, what do they have to offer us in terms of how we understand Mammon? Do they have anything to say to us in terms of how we understand race? And I'm putting that in, you know, listeners can't see me putting it in scare quotes. But, you know, race was invented, you know, in the modern age. Mm-hmm. But, you know, might the church fathers have to say something about it to us as well?
Man, if there is one thing common to, and this is why, I mean, I pull on Basil of Caesarea and John Chrysostom particularly, but I like especially the Greek folks. Because like if there's one thing that they understand as fundamental to Christian ethics, it's care for the poor.
Yeah.
And it's like inextricable. Like it's just obvious.
Right.
But also, I mean, Chrysostom has a number of sermons where he names Mammon as a specific enemy and as one that, you know, and as one that we we're constantly up against. So the epigraph at the very beginning of my book is from his homilies on the Gospel of John. And Chrysostom says, "Perhaps one of you will say, every day you talk about covetousness or greed. Would that I could speak about it every night too. Would that I could do so following you about in the marketplace and at your table. Would that both wives and friends and children and domestics and tillers of the soil and neighbors and the very pavement and walls could ever shout forth this word. For this malady hath seized upon all the world and occupies the souls of all, and great is the tyranny of Mammon." And I mean, you've got folks who, you have folks who, just in looking at their actual lives, who were like born in riches and actively gave it up because they saw Christ's words to the rich. And so they did that, gave it up, followed Christ, and then encouraged the people whom they led. Hey, look, this is what a Christ-like life actually looks like. And there's true joy and true power and true strength found in that. That was Basil's story. John has his own, but one of the things that that struck me particularly about them was that specific commitment, and then it reminded me of the fact that like that's just a commitment that's just deeply scriptural. Like just all throughout the Bible. It's one of the basic things that Jesus calls us to do and ways in which he calls us to live. In the Sermon on the Mount, these three fundamental practices in the beginning of Matthew 6: fasting, prayer, solidarity with the poor. Like that's just like these are just obvious. These are just like obvious things to Jesus. But we find ourselves in a political economy that sees the poor and thinks, well, you're in this position because you probably did something, or you mismanaged your funds in some way. So it encourages us to default to judgment rather than defaulting to mercy. And so we hear Chrysostom's words where he's like, need is the poor man's is the only recommendation the poor man needs for you to give to them. We hear Jesus say, anyone who asks of you, give it to them. And we're like, yeah, but like there are probably exceptions. And so we think about those exceptions and then move away from the needy. And one of the things that at least especially Basil and Chrysostom do is like, listen to Jesus. Mm-hmm. Listen to Jesus and actually do those things. So if there's one thing that I think was deeply impressed on me, particularly by the Greek church fathers, it was that. Because but as another point, and I do this at the very end of the book, I reflect on Jesus' conversation with the rich young ruler. And in a lot of Western interpretation, and this follows from Clement and Augustine, a lot of Western interpretation sees that text as primarily about like the way that the rich young ruler thinks about his wealth. Mm. And so as though the issue was just, well, like if he had just thought about his wealth differently, things would have been different.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Basel presses is like, no, like actually him having that much was an issue.
Yeah.
He has this great line that it was will stick in my mind for the rest of my life. And he says that the more that you abound in wealth, the more you lack in love. Yeah. Because the more that you are abounding is the less that you are sharing.
Yes. Yes.
And fundamentally we were created not to be producers or consumers, but to fundamentally be sharers, because everything that we have is a gift from the Lord, specifically given to us in order that we might share it.
Yes.
And so like that anthropological and theological framing is just basic. Like, it's basic, but it is deeply contrary to the things that we're constantly told on a regular basis.
Yeah. I collected, a while back, a series of quotes from Basel, about, social justice essentially, and that kind of thing. And I actually looked it up as you were talking, and the quote that you're talking about, I just want to read it because I think it really hits pretty hard with what you're saying, like in regard to the rich young ruler. For if what you say is true, this is a quote, for if what you say is true, that you have kept from your youth the commandment of love and have given to everyone the same as yourself, then how did you come by this abundance of wealth? Right? Oh, man.
Well, that's all the time we have for today.
That's the thing. So you have folks like Clement Clement does that where he's like, you know, Jesus just expresses how much he loves this guy, that he didn't do anything wrong. Right. And Basel's point is like, no. He failed to obey the great commandment of loving your neighbor as yourself. You're like, you name all these other commandments, but you fail to love your neighbor as yourself when there are needy people around you and you've got all this stuff.
Yeah.
And especially in an agricultural economy, it's obvious in a neoliberal, financialized and racialized capitalism like we have, it's more complex.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the modes are still the same. The temptations are still the same. There may be more layers that we're in. Like Mammon has basically created more layers that we have to get behind to understand the way that this exploitation works, but it's the same kind of exploitation.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're just encouraged to not actually think about it in those ways.
Yeah.
The blinders are just getting thicker and thicker and thicker. And one of the things that I want to at least begin to do is begin to remove those blinders so that we can actually live lives of Christlikeness.
Yes. Which I want to return to something you said before we press on to like part two in that little triangle of resistance you name. But I think it's I've been doing this for a while, and I may have picked it up from you even, Malcolm, of referring to the kingdom of God as God's political economy.
Mm.
And the reason I've been doing that is to because kingdom is such a spiritual word that doesn't involve material things.
To anybody hearing the word kingdom, like they're going to think about that. But to us now.
Yeah, in our tradition, though, right? And it's spiritual, and that's the opposite of material.
Yeah.
Right? And material actually is aspiritual. Mm-hmm. And so it's somehow unspiritual or only spiritual in reference to what your little heart does to it. Mm-hmm. Right, so that money isn't a spiritual, doesn't have spectral power in our world, but you give it power by what your affectations do to it, and this is thoroughly sub-Christian. And so, talking about as a political economy, then reinvigorates our imagination to understand that the kingdom of God, i.e., God's political economy, actually makes claims and orders our relationships and attachments to everything.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So then doctrine and dogma of what are people for? What's a job for? What are possessions for? What are clothes for? Right? Mm-hmm. What is my time for? Like all those things, I think, want to be colonized by Mammon in ways that make us really, really greedy Christians. And so I just want to return to that to say, even the habit of speech we use can create dissonance or create little cracks in our understanding that we can then, I think, repent and recover a more faithful imagination for how to live as holy dissidents to this, you know, to this tyrant.
One of my whole things is that, I do this in the book too, I want us to really think about how the scriptures define love. Because we're all on the same page that Christ has told us to do two things, to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbors as ourselves.
Yeah, let's get into this. This is the second part of your book. It's very constructive. What do we do about this, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so say more.
So the thing about, so then the question is like, okay, well, like, what does love mean? Does it just mean that I like feel a particular way about a bunch of people? Because that's the way that our conversations about race would have me think.
Exactly.
That I love black people because I have friends who are black, and that's great.
I can't be racist.
I
can't be racist because I watch Family Feud and I like Steve Harvey.
Yeah, exactly, right? But I asked the question, okay, well, like, what, how is love defined in the scriptures? Well, we're told in 1 John 3:16, we're told that this is how we know what love is, that Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, therefore we ought to lay down our lives for one another. Great. Okay. But like, what does that mean? Well, he goes on in verse 70, he says, if any of you has material, but if a brother or sister needs food or clothing, and any of you has material possessions and has no pity on them, how can you say that the love of God is in you? Okay, what that seems to indicate to me is that love requires a kind of material investment. Oh, and then James, when he goes into this whole faith works thing, what's the works that he ends up being that he ends up talking about? If somebody has food or clothing, huh? And if you just say, go be warm and well fed, what does that do? Huh? It seems to be the case that love is a material investment in one's neighbor or brother or sister. Or let's think about love of enemies. Does it mean that I've got to think nicely about my enemies or whatever? Well, Paul in Romans 12 says, okay, never seek revenge, but instead always leave room for the wrath of God, because vengeance is mine, says the Lord. And then he quotes the proverb and says, if your enemy is hungry, you feed them. If your enemy's thirsty, you give them something to drink. So it seems to suggest that even my love of my enemy, that love of enemies, looks the same way that love of neighbor and love of my brother or sister does, which is a material investment in those people. So this is one of the things that presses, not only my pressing for economic solidarity, but also my pressing for creative anti-violence, because it means that every human being that I come into contact with is actually a human being to be loved, even somebody who wants to kill me. That's going to be hard for a lot of people.
Yeah. This is great. I mean, this is our whole project here at Gravity, is to rehabilitate love from the chicken soup for the soul Hallmark card dustbin. That actually love is the most powerful force in the universe.
Yeah.
And we actually have to become better acquainted with and more competent in how love works.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I want to press is that God's most prominent acts of love for his people are deeply material.
Yeah.
His creation of us, his liberation of his people from Egypt, the incarnation, his death and resurrection, the return of Christ, all these things are deeply material realities. Mm-hmm. Like that's how God has chosen to express his love for us. Mm-hmm. Thus, that's also the way that we're called to express our love for our neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's not that the fact that we have come to oppose the material and the spiritual means that we have failed to understand what the spiritual actually is.
Yeah.
And so, like, I mean, the most spiritual things that God has done for us are also deeply material. They're mm-hmm. deeply material realities. Yeah. Ending in the ultimate commingling of the material and the spiritual, which is the final vision, in many ways, the final vision that we are given of the saints ruling with Christ in the new heavens and new earth.
Yeah.
Is not just like us having thrones like on the side of the big throne, but as Jesus encourages the church at Laodicea, which is interestingly lukewarm because it's rich, he says, if you actually do follow me, he says, to the one who overcomes, I will give to them to sit with me on my throne, just as when I overcame, I sat with my Father on his throne. Which is to say, we don't get thrones alongside Jesus. We get to sit on his with him. That's insane. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely insane. And Mammon would have us think that there is something else that we should seek that is better, that's going to lead to a better future than that. And we it's why Laodicea makes Jesus nauseous, because he's like, why would you settle? Why would you settle for that when I've got this? When I've got this for you? And so this is one of the hopes of the book is to paint a little bit of that vision so that people realize like this is not only what Christ has for you, but he has actually given you the resources to actually live in this way and to show the world that there's another way of living.
Yeah.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
The game is on the line, and I've only got a shot clock's worth of time to tell you about Subway's $6.99 foot-long deal. That's right. Order now in the Subway app and get any foot-long on the menu for just $6.99. Fresh sliced deli meat, fresh crispy veggies. Ugh, too much good stuff. Get it now on the Subway app. Any foot-long for just $6.99. Use code 699FL now. Only here for a limited time. Redeemable at participating U.S. restaurants. Subway app, online orders only. Add-ons, additional plus tax. Additional fees apply on delivery. Excludes foot-long snacks. Limited time.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
It strikes me, Malcolm, as both easier and harder in different ways, right? Than sort of trying to do what we're currently doing, you know, as the capital C church. And I think, you know, it's harder because we are having to confront some of our deepest like alliances with Mammon, you know, maybe in the depths of our souls, like our commitment to our own self-preservation at the expense of others, you know, might be we have to confront that. So it's harder than, you know, just, I don't know, doing what we're doing now. But in some ways like the materiality of it almost feels easier to me, because love your enemies now doesn't need to mean feel nice, warm fuzzies about them. I don't need to feel warm fuzzies. I just need to be committed to not killing them. You know, I just need to be committed to their well-being. You know, if they're hungry, well, I'm going to feed, you know, I can do that actually with my body while, you know, through gritted teeth maybe, or like while feeling a lot of hatred maybe even in my heart.
It's possible.
I can feed them, you know, as an act of love. I can actually do that. You know,
it's harder. And the thing is, even that act, I mean, this is how love is actually cultivated, is through action. Too.
Yeah.
Like if I just sit in my room, I was like sit in my room with the goal of loving somebody. Like that's not gonna do anything.
It's not gonna happen. Now,
when I am actually forced to be in proximity with them and provide for their need and things like that, like that's the way that that actual affection is also built. Yes. And so it's just. And I think we get this through the scriptures we're also people who are, we're creatures of habit. We're shaped by our habits. It's one of the reasons why in the beginning of Matthew 6, Christ, when he talks about fasting, prayer, and giving to the poor, he says, like, don't do this for attention, but he still wants you to do those things.
Right. Yeah.
Because there are things that shape you, because there are things that shape you into the kind of person that God is seeking to shape you, to shape you into. And so I think that's something that's important.
Yeah.
Oh man, there's so much more to go into. We didn't even get into like how you I mean, I was an undergrad history major. I love holding history and conversation with theology and conversation with economics. Like I love the project you're working on, Malcolm, and how God's uniquely gifted you to bring some good to us. So you trace some stories from historical characters. You talk about lynching in this book and how it relates to the subject. We just don't have time to get into all that. Maybe as we go, you talk about, you know, you mentioned like creativity and love, and you talk about anti-violence. Now, that's a phrase that I learned from feminists who did not like the phrase nonviolence.
Yeah.
Because of how passive
Right.
It seemed. And a lot of the wounding in feminist circles has come from being dominated or being being passive in the face of violence.
Yeah.
I think the phrase anti-violence is provocative and helpful, but I'm curious, maybe it's to close. Why do you choose that way of pushing back against mammon? What is that? What possibilities does that phrasing open for us that we need? And what are some experiments we can play with?
Yeah.
In creative anti-violence.
So I think mammon, like any idol, is a bloodthirsty one. And so it demands our blood. It demands the blood of our neighbors. It demands the blood of our brothers and sisters. It demands even the blood of our enemies. And so when I think about what creative anti-violence means, it means not only a refusal to engage in violence, but also a commitment to undermine it wherever we find it. Because it's an active commitment. It's not just, I see violence, let me run away from it. It's, I see my brother or sister suffering under violence. What does it mean for me to, what does it mean for me to come alongside them and protect them? And that's also kind of fundamental to my understanding of love. Like that's just, I can't conceive of killing my neighbor as an act of love. So like it's not an option. And also I can't conceive of seeing my neighbor killed and being fine with that being an act of love either. And so I'm gonna seek to undermine it. And so in thinking about some possible experiments, This goes into kind of the building relationships of deep economic solidarity as an expression of this. In Acts 2, after the Spirit descends on the people of God, they're marked by four things: devotion to the apostles' teaching, prayer, the breaking of bread, and the fellowship, koinonia, which is the sharing of goods. Which is to say that the economic witness of the church is actually central to its identity. And so I try to encourage Christian communities, like, think about the resources that you have and think about what it would mean for you to build a community without need. So building a community where people understand themselves as fundamentally sharers, where people are not afraid to ask for help, and where they are actually met with that help. And then what does that look like for you to spread that to other church communities around you, such that when the world sees you, they're like, whoa, that's different. I've never seen something like that before. To which our response is, well, repent and believe, and you can get in on this too. The church is meant to be an invitational community. The church is meant to be a community that shows the rest of the world, hey, look, this is what the kingdom of God looks like. Guess what? You're invited. But if we're like the church in Laodicea, room temperature, where we just match the assumptions, the assumptions and the vibes of the world around us, there's no invitation. They're just like, well, why would we go there? It's just the same as what we got going on out here. And so one of the ways that we are distinct, is by our love, which is exactly what Jesus says in John 13. You're going to know my disciples by their love for one another. And so one of my things is just to be reminded of how material that love is supposed to be.
Yeah. Yes, and how material the violence is. Amen. The book, again, is called The Anti-Greed Gospel, Why the Love of Money is the Root of Racism, and How the Church Can Create a New Way Forward. Malcolm, thanks so much for being with us today.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to chat with you.
Ben, I hope you were paying attention.
Of course I was.
Yeah.
Because are you saying this was an intervention for me having
there
Malcolm
was some
on here?
Things in there. I
you
was
in particular are we supposed to pay attention?
What grabbed you? What struck you? What do you want to explore more that he was chatting about?
Yeah, I think for me, just that idea that's such a potent and powerful idea that begins to unmask the power of mammon, the way that mammon works, is to recognize that racism is really about mammon. Racism is really about greed. Racism is really about responding to this sort of fear of death that we all have, kind of, I think, you know, after the fall. And the promise of that mammon makes that, well, you know how to, you know how you can avoid death, or you know how you can have your needs met, is if you amass more resources than your neighbor. And it sort of unfortunately requires exploitation. You know, it's like even the invention of race, I think, goes to show how uncomfortable we actually are with exploitation. We don't actually want to be those kinds of people who do that. And so we create these categories. Anyway, so I think that's a really powerful idea, and it begins to sort of reveal what's behind all of this. And, you know, even in our own lives, you know, like I don't think you or I or a lot of our listeners have like millions of dollars.
No.
Right? That we have to reckon with wealth in that way. But all of us do have to reckon with, how do I think about my resources, you know? What do I do when I see someone in need?
Yeah.
All those kinds of things.
Yeah. 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 I think there is I think one of the things I hear when we start to talk about either race or mammon is people can only think about it in very binary, stark, categorical, extreme things. You know,
yeah.
Either I want to lynch people and as a virulent racist, or I don't have a racist bone in my body. Like, right. Those are the two options.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Or either mammon isn't a problem if I love my kids more than money.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Or you have to sell everything and live like St. Francis of Assisi.
Right.
You can have as much money as you want, as long as you don't love it more than God. Mm-hmm. Or you have to sell all you have and live on the streets.
Yeah.
Those ways of thinking, I think they're part of the apparatus that keeps mammon in power, first of all.
Yeah.
Because it collapses our agency and imagination to do anything about it, and we just forget about it.
Right.
But two, it also misses out on just some wonderful, like, little, like all kinds of stories we have in the scriptures of people who are embedded in systems or realities of injustice, and then run creative schemes of resistance.
Yeah. Yeah, it's never going to be a perfect, you know, and I think even that desire, like I've had to confront that in myself, I think. Like even that desire to sort of like become pure, like completely extricate oneself and just sort of know, it's almost like an idolatry of morality or something, or an idolatry of purity, where instead of actually just doing something that might help, you know, move us in a certain direction that might be less than perfect, and we might make some mistakes, we might look like an idiot. Instead of doing anything like that, you know, we're sort of paralyzed by this lack of purity that comes with, just running experiments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can be committed to anti-racism and own that I'm complicit in white supremacy. I can be committed to an anti-greed gospel and own that much of my life and logics and values are colonized by mammon.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm thinking too, just about like, that's like maybe the imaginative work that needs to happen as we think about our position. But I'm even thinking about just like material things that you can actually do. I remember when we were, I can't remember where I read about this, but Jacques Ellul, do you know that guy? He's a French philosopher, theologian.
Yeah.
But he talked about the power of money. I don't think he used the word mammon. I think he just capitalized money. Mm-hmm. Kind of indicate that. The same kind of thing.
We'll let it slide, Jacques.
It's all right. It's all right. I mean, he probably wrote in French too, so who knows how that all works. But anyway, but he said that the main way of exercising, meaning like casting out a demon, the main way of exercising mammon is by giving money away. Like, it's just simple. Like there's a simple thing you can start with, which is, do I have any extra money? You know, like, like what could I give away? You know, like, I don't need to sell everything I have, but what would it look like to give some money away? Just like start with that and see where it leads you. You know what I mean? That kind of simplicity, I think, is helpful just to say, we'll go ahead, you know?
Yeah.
Give some money away to someone who needs it and see how that goes. And then do it again, you know?
Yeah.
Well. Anyway.
That's probably enough.
Yeah. Listener, give some money away.
We've talked enough. Now it's time to give some money away. All right. Well, until next time, listener, stay anti-greedy and anti-violent.
And anti-violent, full of love.
Do it. Love it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.